Well, this evening we begin the 20th chapter of Luke, chapter 20, message 173, and the last four chapters of Luke. They'll be quite lengthy, especially as you get towards 23 and 24. Then after we finish Luke's gospel, and those of us who are here in the fellowship, we'll be going through the book of Revelation. Some of you who are listening will be getting the Revelation and the Isaiah series, and you know who you are, and if not, you know who you will be very soon. Remember, this is on the backdrop of Jesus in chapter 19 teaching in the temple after he cleaned out the temple of all the corruption that was going on from the religious leadership. He cleaned out the temple because the temple became worthless, because the purpose of why the temple existed, and that is a house of prayer, the Father's house, and the house of worship, it was all done away with and corrupted once all the making of money and wealth and all kinds of business went on within the temple that had nothing to do with the purpose of why the temple was made. And as far as the religious leaders were concerned, as long as no one rocked the boat and business was going on as usual, you know, they tolerated the evil because they were participants of it. They profited from it. And at the same time, they gave the impression to the people that they could still worship the Lord. And historically, according to the Bible, this was a particularly persnickety habit among the Jewish leaders within the temple. It was always this corruption going on. During times of apostasy, during times before captivity in particular, you'd always find the Old Testament, the leadership, the priests and others, allowing in the corrupting influence of the nations surrounding them. They were always taking the temple and corrupting it with idolatry. So historically, this isn't anything new that we have seen here in Luke. In our studies of the Old Testament, we've seen very clearly this was something that went on quite a bit. So the tradition just continued on. But God the Son came and cleaned out the temple. Obviously, it upset a lot of people whose livelihood to one degree or another was tied into all the corruption that went on in the temple. And so he's teaching, and then the people, and then you go into chapter 20, which links to that flow of his teaching. And it came to pass on one of those days as he taught the people in the temple. So it ends with him teaching in the temple. Chapter 20 begins with him teaching in the temple. It ends with the Pharisees intent to and desire to want to kill him, but they were afraid of him because the people were paying attention to them. And this is interesting point that's going to be brought up in this 20th chapter. In spite of the fact that the religious leaders were the religious leaders, it seems to me they were beholden a lot to fear the people. They were very concerned about making wrong moves that could really cost them their life. We'll see that in chapter 20, when Jesus asked him about whether they believed the ministry of John the Baptist was of God or of men. And they pondered their answer carefully because they recognized if they said that John's ministry was of men, they feared they would be stoned to death by the people. So there was always this fear that they had towards the people. That's why they didn't just rush in and seize Jesus when they wanted to, because they were concerned about the people. And as we'll find way later, God willing, in the study of the trial of the so-called trial of Jesus, was just a mock trial, that they did all this stuff in the darkness and in the night where cases never really were held. They didn't want the people rising up against them. So we'll take a look at all that. But the transition again, Jesus is teaching, the religious leaders are plotting. Chapter 20, Jesus is teaching, the religious leaders are plotting. And so all that continues to escalate as he gets to Jerusalem, and it continues to escalate as he heads closer and closer to the inevitable death for which he came. It came to pass that on one of those days, as he taught the people in the temple and preached the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes came upon him with the elders. Now again, and I've been doing it all through Mark, I've done it through Matthew many years ago in the 90s, I've done it in John's gospel, and I'm doing it in Luke. I'm going to continue to say, which is what we saw in chapter 19, and I'm going to keep saying this till it sinks into our minds and the minds of those who are hearing and watching, that Jesus was a preacher of the gospel and a teacher. He was always teaching. He was always preaching. The emphasis over and over and over again in Scripture is the fact that Jesus was a teacher. You always see him teaching. And I've been emphasizing this truth constantly, and it is clear to those who really want to see it. Now, you'd have to just simply ignore it. A guy brought out a very good point to me Saturday. I never really thought about it. He said, when a person is ignorant, it doesn't mean necessarily stupid. He said, a person who's ignorant is someone who ignores the truth. I went, that's a good point. So ignorance really means to ignore, because ignorance is a part of ignorance. Ignore is a part of it. You ignoring what the truth is. I said, that's a very interesting point. That a lot of people see the truth and they're ignorant because they choose to ignore what is already before them, the evidence that's there. And so Jesus was a teacher. And I know teaching today seems rather boring, and a lot of people see and hear what I'm doing and others who are doing similar things is quite boring. But the fact of the matter is they would be bored with Jesus as well. If they're bored with the truth now, they would be bored with him. It is clear for those who want to see it that Jesus was a teacher and a proclamator or proclaimer of the gospel. He taught and he preached. He did that in the temple. He was one who systematically instructed the people. He also proclaimed the good tidings or the good news of the gospel of God. Did both, obviously. There was no hooping. That's nonsense. That's a bunch of nonsense. There's none of that junk in the Bible. No singing the Bible. No style points. No glamour. No showmanship. All these things today and throughout church history are just being done to accommodate those who are really spiritually dead and to just to entertain lost people. Some people like plays. Some people like going to the theater. I mean, I don't mean the movie theater. I mean the live theater. I don't think I've ever been to two since we've been married, and zero before we were married. So maybe you made me go to the theater. I don't know. We've been to two theater productions. I mean, it's not something where, oh, honey, we're all going to go. No, that's just not part of it. Well, some people like that. And some people like to go and see the symphony play. I've never been to one of those. Some people like to go to the sporting arenas. And today and every Sunday, you see it and hear thousands and thousands and billions of people going to sporting events and soccer in Mexico and all kinds of Olympics. So sports are really big. People like that. Then some people go to the movies and they want to see stuff on the huge screen, and 10 days later they're going to buy the DVD and Blu-ray and they're going to stick it in their, you know, mini huge screen the size of this wooden piece of junk entertainment center, which is older than dirt, and they're going to put it in there, or they're going to get rid of the entertainment center and get a TV that's too big on purpose so that they have to get another one. So everyone has this. And some people, for some very odd reason, I think it goes to the issue of their alleged morality within. Some people like to go to church. They like religion. Some people like religion. Some people like what they consider that which is spiritual. Now, when I use the word spiritual, I use it in the general sense. It doesn't have any meaning, particularly mean to what is spiritual, but they call it spiritual. You know, some holistic doctors teach that, you know, to properly heal people, you have to deal not only with the physical, but with the spiritual. I heard it this morning. You have to deal with the spiritual aspect of the person. So it's all, some people have all these different kinds of bents. And so whatever your bent is, there's always going to be some so-called teacher is going to try to accommodate whatever it is you want. Some churches have movies, some churches have theater or theater. Some churches have orchestras, some churches have everything I named and then some. Sporting events, hey, they have it all. Some of the colleges and seminaries, I told you already, you know, the biggest part of their budget is not evangelism, it's sports. You know, they want to be a part of NCAA. They want to be a part of, you know, the Big Ten or the Southeast Conference or whatever. So they put millions and millions of dollars in recruitment because their sports is what they emphasize, or their baseball team or their basketball team or their football team. Because to them, they can't draw in quality players, okay, or potential quality players unless they have a quality team. So that becomes a huge part of their budget. Not evangelism. They care less about souls. They want to make that money and get that prestige, because along with a good team comes prestige. I mean, after all, you must be spiritual if you have a great baseball team. How ridiculous is that? No showmanship. There's no beauty that we desire of him. He was just a person who taught with the authority of God and his own authority. He simply taught. He simply preached. He continually was teaching and preaching the people, which was one of the great aspects of his ministry, which, sad to say, is overlooked in the pattern that he demonstrated. He demonstrated this. The Bible teaches that we are to follow his example. I would imagine his example in leadership was the teaching and preaching. Why aren't we following that example? Okay, instead of, well, whatever. As consistent as Jesus was a teacher and a preacher to the people, the Sanhedrin delegation was as consistent to try to interfere with his ministry. So just as much as he was consistent in what he was doing, so were the religious leaders. So were the Sanhedrin council and members that they sent to spy him out, as we'll see in this chapter. They were very consistent. They saw him as the greatest threat. And Paul mentioned a great threat to Judaism. I don't think these men, well, I don't see it, okay? I mean, Paul mentioned his relationship to the Pharisees and others in the Jews' religion. I don't think these men here cared one whit about Judaism. I think their basic fundamental issue was that they were extortioners, that they had the shell, the outward shell of religion as leaders, but they had nothing divine going on. Obviously, that's true because they crucified the Son of God. I mean, if you were spiritual, you'd be running to the Son of God. They were running to him, right? Running to him to try to kill him. And once again, we see the absolute rudeness of the religious elite who blurted out questions as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple. And always keep in mind the absolute hatred of these men towards Jesus, and it should not surprise you when you see this kind of behavior towards him. They hated him without a cause. They hated Jesus. They had no affection for him. They did not care one whit about him or the effects of his ministry towards the people. I told you this with Paul, and I told you this with the Lord. They have to discredit the speaker so they can discredit the ministry, because the ministry comes with the man. So if you discredit the person, you don't have to worry about anything else. Just discredit the person. And all of a sudden, you know, everything you've done is meaningless to people. Now, I know this is a stretch because I can give you a lot more illustrations that I think would bear more credibility. But today I'm looking at what some people are trying to do to Tiger Woods. I mean, regardless what happened to him and how the accident happened in his house, it seems like people are trying to take this incident and destroy this man. They don't even know the man. The man plays golf better than anybody in the world, as far as I'm concerned. He's earned his stripes, you know, he got his due because he whooped everybody. He keeps whooping them. Now, one agency reported that he had a fight with his wife. And she ran in his face, fine. He got in his truck and, you know, she took that 9-iron and knocked out that windshield. fine. And maybe he got so scared, he turned around to see what happened. He crashed the fire hydrant, then crashed the tree. Great. It's none of your business. What happened to him? You don't go around telling everybody when you have issues with your wife, do you? He's a public figure. It's none of your business. It's none of your business what happened to Tiger Woods. None of your business what happens to anybody else, unless you're willing to put yours out there. And I thought, frankly, police reports were private. You know, he said, look, we're cutting off all interviews even with the police at this point until this thing gets resolved. I don't want my, he said, I'm not a perfect man. They're trying to discredit him. And listen, there's no other reason to discredit Tiger Woods other than to discredit what he does. It's incredible. It's like the media is on a frenzy to destroy everybody they can. Everybody see a threat to whatever. It's like they just want to devour them, to take what little tidbit of information they got without even verification and just ruin them. You look at how, well, Tiger Woods got to a serious, is in serious condition. He wasn't in serious condition. FHP's policy is everyone that gets transported to a hospital is considered in serious condition. That's insane. It means you come with a paper cut. Oh, you're in serious condition. Why? And then they change the ticker 3 or 4 times because really they don't know what happened to him. But they try to discredit the man because the man is great at what he does. They always seem to do that. And they pick certain people to do that. Other people can be rabid dogs. They don't even care. In fact, they encourage their wolfness, as it were. You know, make them bigger dogs. But other people who just try to discredit people. And so back to the text there, they hated the Lord. They tried to discredit him so they can discredit his ministry. And when that didn't work, then they tried to get him arrested. If we can't discredit the Lord, let's just get rid of him. Now, we can get him to say something, anything that can be incriminating legally, then we can have Pilate arrest him. We just want him out of the way. He's messing with our money, our gig, our monopoly, our mall, our shopping center, our business, our fake religion, our duping of the people. We got to get him. He's telling the truth. He's performing miracles. We got to get rid of this guy because we ain't performing nothing. We deceiving everybody. So, we ain't teaching nothing. We got to get rid of him. Because our tradition means everything to us, even though it has no bearing upon anybody spiritually. But we got to get rid of him because we just got to get rid of him. He done messed up our gig. So the religious big guns come into the temple. Notice who came in. The chief priests, the scribes, with the elders. So here's this big entourage. Dun, 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 dun. The big guns. And they walk into the temple with all their robes and hats and phylacteries and all the pomp and pageantry and pomposity that came along with it. Because, you know, these were vain, pompous dudes. They come walking, dun, 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 dun. And they came in there, and he's teaching the people, and they just come right up to him. Because, I mean, came upon him. They came suddenly. He was teaching, bum, 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 and they all just walk up to him. It's amazing. So they came in there, and they began their interrogation. And it's basically, I say minimum of, maybe more, 2 unique forms of interrogation, or 2 ways that people use to intimidate in their interrogation. The first one, is intimidation. So the interrogation begins with intimidation. Here they come bursting into the temple, you know, bum, 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 and they rush up upon the Lord. So that it's that intimidation. They try to catch him off guard, try to frighten him with all this authority. And these were people with authority. That's important too. These would be like all the well-known evangelical, you know, pompous preachers preaching everywhere, their big honking churches, you know, coming up against some little nobody and, you know, pump up, and they just all, you know, bum rush you and try to get you all scared. That's part of interrogation. You see it on some TV programs. All people do, they got this, first thing, they sit a person behind a desk for like an hour to get them all nervous. And the room is quiet, he's just thinking in his mind. Got that see-through mirror, you don't know what's going on. That's all part of the interrogation to get you nervous. And then here comes the big wig, open up the door. And they just kind of look at you while they close the door. You know, you all scared now. That's part of interrogation's intimidation. That's phase one. The text said that they came upon him with the elders. The intent was to scare him, to catch him off his guard. They all came in the temple and rushed upon him immediately and at once. And the second part of interrogation is questioning. Okay. And they didn't ask him what he was teaching. They went right to the foundation of teaching. Now, these were men of authority, and so they're asking him, tell us, the authorities. We are representatives of the Sanhedrin. We are the authority, local and regional authority. We have the authority. So tell us, the authority, by what authority dost thee doest thou these things, or who is he that gave thee this authority? They didn't come as inquisitors. They were representatives of the Sanhedrin, the elders as well. They were the ruling authority in that day. They want to know, well, where did you get the authority to do what you were doing? That is, cleaning out the temple. Where did you get the authority to just assume the position of a teacher? You have an ongoing teaching ministry. Where did you get that authority? And who gave it to you? Because the people knew who the authority was. Could you imagine 10, 15, 20 or more big pompous robed giant wearing hat phylactery wearing dudes and they stand right surrounding Jesus? They knew who the authorities were. The authorities dressed as the authorities. They knew. That was all part of the interrogation. They knew he spoke with authority, but that's not really the issue. But we know that he spoke with authority, not as the scribes. This is Mark chapter 1, verses 21 and 22. And when they went to Capernaum, and straightway on the Sabbath day, he entered into the synagogue and he taught, and they were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one that had authority, not as the scribes. So there was a definite comparison between how he taught and how they taught. We know the synagogue, of course, like the temple, was a place for religious worship. And the duty or the leader of the ruler or the rule of the synagogue was to select the readers or teachers in the synagogue to examine the discourses or the teaching of the public speakers and to see that all things were done with decency and accordance to ancestral usage. The traditions of the synagogue, traditions of the temple never altered. So at the invitation of the ruler of the synagogue, Jesus began to teach, and boy, did he teach. And the response of the people was they were astonished at what he said, at his doctrine. For he taught. So they were astonished at the content of what he said and the manner in what he said, or the manner in which he spoke. Okay. One writer said the crowds, quoting, were almost knocked out of their senses when they heard him saying. I mean, when Jesus spoke, people were absolutely dumbfounded. They were astonished, amazed, aghast at listening to the divine. Now, obviously, none of that happened with these old dried up sausages. They didn't pay them no mind. There was a unique and divine, infinite difference between Jesus' teaching and the teaching of the religious leaders of that day. The word astonished means to strike a person out of his senses by some strong feeling such as fear, wonder, or even joy. Understand that these folks were familiar to a certain type of teacher, that is, the scribes. When Jesus taught, he taught with the power of God. They were in panic, in shock and amazement, and of course, they were absolutely stunned. But that's not the issue here. Okay. Their reaction to Jesus' words was nothing like the boredom that was heard in the synagogues. I mean, the scribes weren't dunces. They knew the law. They were interpreters of the law. Okay. But having the knowledge of the scriptures does not mean that you or your teaching has any authority behind it. The scribes were men that were learned in the scriptures. They were learned in the Mosaic law and in the sacred writings. But they had no authority. Why? Because they, like their religious contemporaries, were more politically motivated and nationalistic than those who truly loved God. That's what distinguished them from everybody else. They were basically a political party. They were corrupted. I'm not saying you shouldn't talk politics, but when that becomes what you are, you're corrupted. You were corrupted. Not only that, but their teachings were so riddled with Jewish traditions that the word of God was long ago abandoned. The Lord said it took no effect. Their tradition superseded scripture. So even though they were knowledgeable in the law, they eliminate the law because the traditions were more important to them than the truth. That's why they had no authority. The authority didn't come from God because it didn't come from his word. Their authority came from traditions. So their teachings were useless. They were worthless to do anything spiritually. Not true of all of them, but certainly true of most of them. And we see again that Jesus' teaching, his doctrine, and his manner are both contrasted against those of the religionists of his day. And he was the source of his own teaching because he's God the Son. Now, Jesus taught with his own authority and or the authority of his Father, whereas the others, scribes, Pharisees, whatever, they went to establish their credibility by quoting the rabbins or the rabbis, saying Hillel says this, Shemaiah says this, or such a doctor says this, and thus, but he spoke from himself. As one sent from God that had an authority from God and was independent of man, and this was what they had not observed from any others, and they were amazed at the hearing of it. Similar, John the Baptist was the same kind of person. John came from the wilderness, and he just popped on the scene. And when he started preaching, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, folks flocked to hear him. He had an authority of God. The Bible said he was a man sent from God. And what designated John's, the reality of his calling from God was he preached God's message. Yeah, people want to turn this into kind of a quiz show. What's the proof of your authority? Well, who do you serve and who do you preach when you talk to people? Not where you get your degree and who gave you some paper authority, fool. And they spake unto him, saying, tell us, by what authority doest thou these things, or who is he that gave thee this authority? Remember, the questions were designed to dissuade the people from following Jesus and to demean his character and his saving message. Because by them, the authorities, or representatives of the authorities, I think they were part of the authority, when they came to him, they were basically saying to the people, because they were saying it to him, but in front of the people, that he doesn't have any authority. That's what they're saying. Where'd you get the authority to do that? Implication is, we're the authority, and we didn't give you the authority to exercise authority. And you couldn't do it in front of, you know, can we talk to you, Rabbi, Master, on the side? No, we got to do it in front of everybody in the middle of your teaching. These men thrived on human religious authority. To them, that was the evidence, the proof, if you please, of religious authority, the authority of men. They thrived on. That's where they got their authority. They got their authority from each other. Somewhere along the line, the last person or the first person who started this has the obligation to tell us where he got his authority. But Jesus told these men, I believe in John's gospel, that you know they love the praise of men. They love men. They seek to please men. They seek the authority of men. That's why Paul said, I don't please man, because I wasn't called by man. These men look to human authority. And frankly, the authority that they would give would only make them, according to Jesus in Matthew's gospel, a twofold more child of hell than themselves. the authority we give to someone would never do these things that Jesus did, because if it was, it would have been done. The authority just continued the pattern of the corruption that went on. And this was and is very important. Jesus did not look for any human authority to teach or to preach, and he never gave the impression that he needed it, as the religionists did in his day. It's sad to say that the few genuine men who are called of God have to be lumped in together with those who have no calling from God to teach or to preach. But for the moment, I just want to refer to those or address those who truly are the called men of God. Those of us who are teachers and preachers of Scripture know that we are called and know who called us, and we know who gave us the authority and where the authority came from. And the evidence is that we serve God with our lives and we preach and teach what he says. I'm not looking to a man and suggest no one else does to authorize anything. If you're called of God, you can't get a higher authority than that. The evidence will be you'll live for God and you'll do what he says. End of story. And I've seen tons of men in my life. I'm not really going to get into this too much because it bothers me even to talk about it. But there are a lot of men that I've seen in my day, and frankly speaking, they all claim the one, I'm called of God, and you know they want me to put their hand on, want me to do, and you look, there's no evidence. They got excited over a few Bible passages and preached a couple of sermons, and that was it. And they want me to rush to slap an ordination certificate in the hand. For what reason? You don't give a person an ordination certificate until they're pastoring a church or in the process of pastoring a church. So here you go, my friend. What are you going to do with it? It's ridiculous. You know, it's ridiculous. Well, you ain't got no man, no religious organization recognize your authority. I didn't need them. And in case you're wondering, I have two ordinations, not just one. Yeah, I got two of them, if that matters, and it really doesn't. To me, Missionary Baptist, that's us Negroes. And believe it or not, I got ordained from Southern Baptist. Talk about a contrast. Blacks and Southerners. All them, and both by Baptist churches. How about that? Well, you ain't no... you're right, I ain't know anything. Whatever label you want to slap it on your own forehead. One guy came, oh, you are this. I said, I'm just a preacher of the word of God. Why can't I just be that? Why do I got to be labeled a Calvinist? No, I'm just a preacher. What's wrong with that? You got to have labels like this, like we're, you know, licking green stamps. You got to have labels. Slap people around with a bunch of stamps like they've been all over the world. You get a stamp when you go to different countries. Like they have a spiritual passport. You got to, it's your passport stamp? Yeah, okay, I'm a this, you know. That's the FDA stamp. The evidence of those who are clearly of God is in the life. I would not be anywhere near any man or men who are hesitant of these facts. I get bothered by people who don't want to express that they are men of God. I don't like telling people I'm a man of God. Well, you probably not, because I don't even know why you would say something so absurd. I mean, why would you want to hide that fact? You don't hide the fact you were born with your last name, even though your family is probably as sinful and corrupt as any other. You probably want to boast about how your family was tight and they hated each other and you too. You know, you don't even want to tell truth about them. But when it comes to wanting to identify with God, you're getting all scared. I tell people, I'm a preacher of God's truth. Well, what's wrong with that? You ought to be concerned if the so-called preacher you serving under, he can't say it or won't say it. Want to try to be humble. You better run for the door. He ain't got no confidence. You better have none in him. No righteous man or men should ever be acting as if they don't know these things. The authority came from God, not man, and we demonstrate that authority by preaching and teaching his word. And frankly, we should expect to receive the same mistreatment from religious people as Jesus did, and especially from other religious leaders. We should be expecting it. We shouldn't think it a strange thing. We should be expecting it. Their questions had also another implication. Remember, he was continuing to teach and to preach. They're like, wait a minute, you don't have an ongoing ministry here now. Okay, it's true throughout his entire ministry. We saw him teaching and preaching everywhere he went, all the synagogues and everywhere he went. And his entire ministry had a tremendous impact upon the people and also upon the authority of the religious leaders. One writer explained it this way. He said, quoting, he was making great changes in the affairs of the temple, and they claimed the right to know why this was done, contrary to their permission, which proves again that they were the authority. He was not a priest, though he functioned as one. He was not a priest ordained by them. Okay? He had no civil or ecclesiastical authority as a Jew. He had no license to do anything. He was not sanctioned by anyone. That's why the authorities ask him these questions, because he had no ecclesiastical legal authority to do what he was doing. It was sufficient authority indeed that he came as a prophet and worked miracles, but they professed not to be satisfied with that, end of quote. That's not enough. We didn't give you the paperwork, brother. In that time, civil and or ecclesiastical authority was mandatory to teach and to preach in the temple. You just couldn't waltz in there without any kind of authority. You just couldn't, you know, someone comes to church, I just want to say, sit your behind. They just want to say what? Who are you? I've had it happen so many times in the past. I just want to say something. What do you want to say? First say it to me in the office, and then I'll decide whether you want to say it in front of here. Because a lot of folks start saying crazy stuff. I say, I got to put an end to this. I just want to say something. Don't say a word. Don't say another word until you and I sit in the office, and I'm going to figure out what you're saying makes some sense, and what you're saying is going to glorify God. Because first, I don't know you, and second, I don't know what your intentions are, and it's always better to be safe than sorry. As I said, civil and or ecclesiastical authority was mandatory to teach and to preach in the temple or synagogue, and Jesus had neither. And he didn't have to have it either. Jesus also had finished turning over the tables of the money changers and threw them all out of the temple. And they wanted to know the issue of authority for that reason. If that be not the main reason, I think it's the main reason. What did you do? I mean, what he did was explosive. No one ever just walks and just start tearing stuff up. You never read anyone doing that. Tables thrown. That I wish I could have been there. Tables flinging, money thrown all over the place. Animals running for their life, flying. The birds looking, flying out there, man. Cages breaking. Got that whip and start whooping their tail. Their folk was running out that temple. Running. Scream, you make my father's house a den of robbers. Whoosh. We are liars. We say, I wish Jesus was. He knocked the walls off these places. So they want to know the authority. Now, we may not see this in our age, but in Jesus' day, what he did in that temple was so clear that the people and the leaders, that the leaders had to confront him. They had to confront him. They were forced to do it. Like, wait a minute. You upset the whole system of things we've been doing for decades. Who are you? Jesus declared in no uncertain terms that every single thing that in that temple was a violation of the purpose of it, and he, as God the Son, exercised his divine authority and cleaned out his father's house, the house of prayer. And when he was yelling, he didn't say, well, I do this in the name of the denomination. He said, this is my father's house. It's not like they didn't hear what he said or meant. They understood what he said. They understood what he meant when he said it. He's saying they knew that the house was the house of God. It wasn't like they didn't know what he was saying or meant. My father's house is you turn my father's house to a house of merchandise. Yeah, one, my house and my father's house. Verse 2, and they spake again, they spake unto him, saying, tell us by what authority doest thou these things, or who is he that gave thee this authority? And he answered and said unto them, I will also ask you one thing, and answer me. Other accounts, and I will tell you by what authority I do these things. I'll answer your question if you answer my question. Well, they fell for it. Obviously, Jesus was under no obligation to answer their question because he already told them the source of his authority and proved it over and over again. So the issue was they simply refused to believe it. That's the issue. He told them over and over and over again and proved it. Why bother answering the question again? They asked Jesus, by what right or authority do you have to do the things that you are doing? And who gave you the right or authority to do it? But this time Jesus turned the table upon them and asked them questions. Actually, one. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or of men? Tell me. Simple question. It was a simple question. But they knew they couldn't answer it, or better not answer it. And they reasoned with themselves, so they set themselves aside and start deliberating. Not to properly answer the question, but not to answer the question. They knew they were trapped. They reasoned with themselves, saying, if we shall say from heaven, he will say, why then believe ye him not? Which is an admission, they didn't believe him. But if we say of men, which you'd have to acknowledge that if you don't believe that he was from God, all people will stone us, for they be persuaded that John was a prophet. That's amazing. The people would stone him to death for blasphemy. They were happy to hear from God. This placed the questioners in the position that they had hoped to have placed Jesus in. A state where they were trapped by their own words. No matter what their answer was, they would have trapped themselves. So if they answer it one way or the other, they're trapped. If they said he was of God, there's a reason. If they say he was of men, they die. So it's the best, it's really the worst of both worlds. You got to answer the question. Now, Jesus did not raise this question as a simple rebuke, as if to say, the authorities could not make up their minds about John. There was a specific reason why he asked that question. They knew who he was. They knew exactly where his ministry came from. But Jesus' question was far more profound. If the religious authorities rightly answered it, that is, if they said the truth that John's ministry was from heaven, they will already have the correct answer to their own question concerning Jesus. That's why the question was irrelevant, because if they recognized who John's authority was, it would automatically answer the question of Jesus' authority. That is, if they respond from heaven, then they were morally bound to believe John. And John pointed to Jesus as the one who came to take away the sin of the world. Clearly, John pointed to Jesus as the one who was preferred before John because he was before him, even though John was older, thus signifying the deity and the eternality of the Lord. If they were willing to acknowledge that John's ministry was directly from God, they would have to acknowledge everything he said about Jesus. Everything he said about Jesus was from God. Right from the start, John expresses the deity of Christ. They'd have to acknowledge what John acknowledged. And John was in a better position to acknowledge it than these men were. So John was teaching as the superior teacher. What John said was greater. They would have to believe it if they believed his ministry was from God. The entire Sanhedrin would be obligated to do what their unbelief refused to do for both ministries of John and Jesus. Acknowledge that they were both from God, even though they already knew it. They knew it. So if they told the truth and answered the question correctly, which they dared not do, they would have their answer about Jesus and his authority. That's why he said it. And when he asked that question, they knew they were stumped. He said, I'll ask you one question. If you answer it, I'll tell you about where I get the authority. then they, oh man, or am I, well, what's the question? Well, the baptism of John, was it from heaven or men? Tell me. Oh no, 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 no. Ah, he got us. So if they say his baptism, and the baptism not means that John was baptized, it means the ministry of John, and the baptisms that he did, including Christ, whether they were from heaven or men, verse 6, and if we say of men, all the people will stone us, all of them. For they be persuaded that John was a prophet. Now you in there with your big robes and big pomp, and you in the synagogue or the temple with all these people. Now, if you answer the question wrong, these folks sitting right here that you tried to dissuade, especially while Jesus, the divine, was teaching them, they'd be getting them rocks and kill your behind right there on the spot. The people clearly knew where John came from and the authority he used. They believed that he was a man sent from God, as the scriptures clearly state. Now, they respond from men that John Baptist's ministry was simply a human thing with no divine authority attached to it. They will not dare utter it for fear of the people, because the people held that John was truly a prophet of God. And notice something about John's ministry as a prophet. John did no miracle. You know, I hear people talk about, oh, well, you got to have miracles to prove that you're a man of God. Anyone want to question John Baptist? You said, well, you know, he was an Old Testament prophet. The Lord said the least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. I don't have to do any miracles. In fact, the miracles don't come from me anyway. They come from God. You examine the doctrine to see whether these things are true or not. Have the sense and the courage to do that. Have the integrity to do that first. And if you think miracles are an indication, let me see yours. If the miracle isn't you got a bigger building either, or you got another 25 students in your college or seminary, that's no miracle. What did you promise those kids to get them in there anyway? How many credits when you give someone like a 10-point advantage in the game or something, how many credits you spot these students for coming to your college or seminary? You want to put all these glowing reports of how your school is growing. You spot me 20, 30 credits, I'll get a degree. I ain't going nowhere near this stuff. So great was their fear of the people that if they gave the wrong answer publicly, they feared that the people would stone them to death. Far from avoiding the religious leaders' questions, Jesus answered it so that they were forced to acknowledge the truth or to avoid it altogether. Any honest seeker of truth at that time, with all of the evidence that they all had, could not fail to see who Jesus is and the authority by which he exercised his power and teaching and the cleaning out of his father's house, the temple. So if they could not discern Jesus' authority, it was because of their previous unbelief that had blinded their minds to God's revelation of who Jesus is. You made a good point earlier about Jesus said, this is my house. You know, I mean, he said it's my house and the Father's house, but he said this is my, you have made my house. I mean, he's clearly telling them who he is. No doubt. And his identity with the Father, well, come on. I mean, this is not rocket science here. So if they could not discern Jesus' authority, it was because their previous unbelief had blinded their minds to God's revelation. They knew who he was. Of course they knew. And that's the stupidity of a non-salvific, spiritually dead religion. It can lie, avoid the simple and obvious answers to the truth, and just hedge and fudge around the answers, or just avoid it altogether. It's worthless and useless. It serves no purpose of the divine except that it's worthy to be judged. And they answered that they could not tell whence it was. You talk about a big old fat juicy devil-filled lie. Religious leaders lie too. Don't think because someone is involved with some big something they don't lie. Listen to me. Many, if not most of these men, already told you are corrupt, but they will do anything to protect that image and to protect what they have built with their hands. We've all known some of these so-called men, some of these so-called priests that were involved in horrible corruptions of every kind. And yet their sons raced to the scene to protect the image so that the ministry became bigger than the corrupt person who founded the thing. If he founded it in corruption, it was corrupt from the get-go. I noticed that all these men that were either involved in immorality or financial whatever, that they got busted, they have thoroughly convinced their drones that no matter what they did, it was okay. Well, the law forgives. It's like, there you go, cliche 101. Nobody's perfect. Don't judge, cliche. The drones accept anything. They don't care. The drones do what they're told. That's all a drone is. A drone just does what he's told. A drone is connected to a head, and the head gives the order to the drone. Drone does whatever he or she is told. There's no Bible necessary. There's no authority from God. The men are corrupted. The people who follow them are corrupt. The people who defend corrupt men are corrupted. I mentioned this morning about these so-called pastors with all these spokesmen. I think that would probably be the worst job in the world because you have to defend a corrupt man. The ball is in your court when you know your honcho is corrupted. I don't care if it's doctrinally, sexually, financially, whatever. When you know he's corrupted and you are the mediator between him and the people, you are 1,000 times more corrupt than he is because you have to lie for him. But initially, when you are confronted with having to tell the truth about this man, and you think about your big honking salaries and your prestige and all that pride, everything that you have accumulated, you're nothing but a twofold more child of hell than the one that you're defending. You're no different than he is. It affects everybody down the food chain, down the chain of damnation. Everyone is affected. But that person that's the spokesman is 1,000 times worse than the person at the top because this person throws his own integrity under the bus to lie for someone he knows is corrupt. Man. You know he's corrupt, but you do it anyway. I don't care, frankly, if it's big or small. You're going to do it anyway. It happens in small, big, small, so-called whatever, schools, seminaries, churches, whatever. It happens everywhere. You surrender your integrity. You have to lie for somebody you know is corrupt. You can have that job. That just gets you more judgment. All these big ministries are corrupted. Full of corruption. I don't care which ones you need. Full of corruption. As well as all these parachurch things too, whatever that is. There's no Bible for that nonsense. And I was told by one president of a parachurch so-called ministry, the reason why he started his little parachurch clique was because he couldn't work his ministry through a local church. He just decided to do it then. Forget, I don't need no church. I don't need to do or follow the pattern of the apostles and what have you. The Bible, I just do what I want to do. So he created his own little thing, which took funding from the church. And he turned, now he's famous in the world and doing talks on radio, blah, 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 blah. And all, it's all corruption. You know, siphoning from the work of God, from the church, and giving out some half gospel, some not another gospel to compete and to destroy the work of the true church as actually teaching the gospel. It's all corrupted. And you folks keep supporting corruption. You think it's okay. It's amazing. The drones, they just do what they're told. They have no mind except the mind of the queen or the mind of the king of the hive. They just do what they're told. I couldn't live like that. I couldn't live my life like that with no thought. You just sit there and accept it. You know, where's your conscience? Do you have a conscience? Amazing. They answered that they could not tell where his baptism came from. And Jesus said unto him, neither tell I you by what authority I do these things. They decided that they would take the road of willful ignorance. Remember, ignoring. They ignored what they knew. This demonstrates what ignorance is. They knew the ministry of John came from God, but they couldn't acknowledge their unbelief because they were worried about what the people would do to them. So they knew where his ministry came from. And they said, well, we don't know. They knew. That's called willful ignorance. Putting on as if they could not answer the obvious truth concerning John and Jesus' ministry. They knew it. Don't tell me they didn't know it. They wouldn't be judged by God if they didn't know it. They knew it. Their equivocation gave Jesus a reason for refusing to answer their questions. As I already stated, they had so much evidence, so many proofs that pointed to the reality of Jesus' identity and authority. They had them. This wasn't some isolated miracle, you know, down here in Tustin. And then way in Garden Grove, there's another alleged report of a miracle. And then in Van Nuys, there's a reporting of another miracle, though unconfirmed. And then down there, way down there in Oceanside, there's another miracle, maybe. And then in San Diego, there's another miracle. It's possible. And in Camarillo, well, you know, there's someone that says something, what have you. And up there in Monterey, someone saw Jesus in a tortilla. The image of Jesus in the tortilla. And someone out in Salinas says, no, it was an ice block. And up in San Francisco, they say, we don't even know the Lord. This isn't what we're talking about here. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people following untold amounts of miraculous healings. There were so many healings and miracles that it all preceded his coming into a city. Word of mouth spread before he even got to cities where he was coming. We enter into a city, people that were sick line up in the streets. Don't you tell me there's some little isolated case here and there? They had all that evidence. They seen it. They knew it. I mean, look at John 9 one day. Look, you see it. Man born blind. Everybody knew this man was a man born blind. Everybody saw him every day at the temple asking for alms. He couldn't see, couldn't work, couldn't do anything to supply his own needs. They knew who the man was. Next thing, you know, bam, he sees. How did that happen? A man named Jesus. He made spittle over the clay and put it in my eyes. I do now. I say, well, how did he do this? And where was it? How did I told you it already what happened. Well, I don't believe you were born, but let me get your parents here. Is this the, yeah, he's our son, but how he was blind. We don't know. We scared of y'all because y'all going to kick us out the temple and all the excommunicators, blah, blah, blah. Well, let me ask you again, how did it happen? I told y'all what you want to be. Is like, we are Moses' disciples. We are Moses' disciples. As of this man, we don't know where he came from. Ain't that a shameful thing? It is amazing that you don't know where he came from. And yet he opened my blind eyes. Oh, it was like slap. Since the beginning of time, it never was heard that a man opened the eyes of the blind. This man would not have got, he could do nothing. Oh, that was it.
You get out. You don't dare teach us. We are the teachers. Get out. Get open the doors. Get out.
Kicked them out. The synagogue. None of the men dealt with the truth. It was right there in front of their face.
We don't know if you're the man that was born blind. Maybe you got a twin blind brother. Bring your parents in here. We'll get confirmation.
They had all the evidence they needed in front of their face like so many. They just want the truth. Period. Period. So many proofs. So much evidence. that pointed to the reality of both ministries. In particular, Jesus' authority and his identity. The rejection of mounds of divine revelation, which was already given, was indeed a slender basis on which to ask for more, because more was not required. They had all they needed. They didn't need any more, and they weren't going to get any more either. It wasn't required. We'll pick up at this point next time and look at this nonsense and the nonsense that they will continue to bring to him. We're going to see one of my favorite but astonishing statements, Lord willing, next time. Verse 20, they watched him and sent forth spies, which should feign themselves just men, that they might take hold in his word. Feign themselves be just men. This is incredible. That's an incredible truth. They feign themselves, disguise themselves as righteous men. Unbelievable. Lord, thank you again for who you are. The truth is right here in front of our face, Lord. You are God the Son, the creator of all things and every person. We don't need to quibble about the authority. We know who you are and where you get your authority. It's inherent because of who you are and your own nature. Lord, let us look at the record, at the testimony, the Bible, and see what it says and rejoice in the truth of it, Lord, and not be fooled and blind by our own stupidity and prejudices against you. Thank you again, Lord, for this teaching. It may it be used to touch the hearts of many. Bless the bread and cup today in Jesus' name. Amen.